This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this program, we talk with one of the world's top experts on geoengineering to cool the planet, Harvard's Dr. David Keith. Then from the UK, Dr. Rose Cairns investigates the internet phenomenon of chemtrails. That's the belief that aircraft are already poisoning the sky. Is it an expression of public fears about geoengineering? I'm Alex Smith. Let's go. When people talk about geoengineering, for or against, one name keeps coming up. For over 20 years, scientist David Keith has kept open the door for discussion and research on climate modification. At Harvard University, David is a professor in the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. He's also a professor of public policy at the prestigious Harvard Kennedy School. Dr. Keith wins awards and criticism for talking about technology to stave off the worst of climate change if we need it. David Keith, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I know you push hard to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and you have a company trying to remove CO2 from the air. But today, I'd just like to pick your brain on technology to artificially cool the planet by blocking out some of the sun's rays. In case anyone doesn't know, David, how would solar radiation management, or SRM, work?
So there are lots of ideas, but to pick perhaps the best known one, one might put sulfuric acid droplets, essentially pollution, in the stratosphere, say 20 kilometers over our heads. And these droplets would be much smaller than raindrops, and they would reflect away sunlight in much the same way as raindrops reflect sunlight. Indeed, a water drop in the stratosphere would do about the same thing, but it would evaporate very fast. The sulfuric acid there is really to prevent the water from evaporating. And I'd say there's what's certain is that it's sort of, in a crude way, possible to do that, and that it would reduce climate changes, for example, by cooling the planet. What is very uncertain are what the risks of doing it would be and how well it would work in actually reducing the climate impacts people care about.
How much cooling could we expect?
Well, that depends how much sulfur you put in the stratosphere. There's lots of ways that one could produce quite large coolings, larger even than the amount of warming we have from accumulated carbon dioxide.
Now, scientists in the Arctic Methane Emergency Group have called for regional SRM in the Arctic right now. They hope to stop the Arctic sea ice loss, to slow glacial melt, maybe prevent large-scale releases of methane. Would you agree that the Arctic would be a place to start?
No. I think that in practice, I don't think there's really actually much scientific basis for those claims. The world's climate is all tightly interconnected, and it's meaningless to think about altering climate in just one place. If that was possible, this would all be politically easier, as each country could, I suppose, figure out its own climate engineering and control its own climate. But that's not the actual planet we live on. So in practice, there might be ways that you could arrange solar geoengineering so as to have a slightly stronger effect in the Arctic, but it would not only affect the Arctic, and it's by no means clear that that would be a sensible way to go about it.
Well, is there a threshold or sign that would make you think it was time to try solar radiation management?
I think that right now what we ought to do is have a much more serious research program. There's been a taboo against serious research on this topic, largely driven by the fear that even talking about this will reduce efforts to cut emissions. And that taboo has meant that there really hasn't been a sustained broad-based research program because scientists in the end follow the research money. And so I think what we need is a broad research program, one that involves people in many countries and many disciplines, that breaks the kind of current small group of us. I'm one of them who've been the kind of dominant researchers in the field. I think that's not healthy and increases the chance of groupthink. And I think we need to begin to experiment with small, you know, controlled outdoor experiments as well to understand some of the risks. And I think only after you've done that and the results, you know, look very promising, would it make any sense to talk about deployment?
So, David Keith, what do we know and what don't we know about the impact of solar radiation management on rainfall?
So we've had a whole variety of climate models, kind of the entire normal set of climate models that are now used for the, say, IPCC forecasts of climate change. And they suggest that moderate amounts of solar geoengineering could reduce the change in precipitation, in rain or snowfall, reduce the changes that are caused by increasing CO2, so that it could work to restrain the climate change in both precipitation and temperature.
So we might have fewer, for example, extreme rainfall events.
Yes. In fact, it looks like it works particularly well for reducing the number of extreme events. And that has to do with the fact that solar geoengineering tends to damp the hydrological cycle a little bit, and that one of the causes of extreme events is to do with the energy in the hydrological cycle.
Might it therefore also cause a drought somewhere?
It's possible. So there's a whole lot of uncertain outcomes. I think that one of the claims is often made is that if you do solar geoengineering, you reduce precipitation and cause drought. I think that is a false claim, and it's based on an assumption that solar geoengineering is used to compensate all of the temperature change from increased carbon dioxide. And if you do that, you would decrease the average global precipitation rates, rain rates. That actually doesn't mean you necessarily cause drought, because it's actually the difference between evaporation and precipitation that causes drought, and you reduce both. But in any case, I don't think anybody is seriously advocating that as a scenario. It simply is a scenario that's been analyzed a lot because it's convenient to analyze. And perhaps because people have an instinct that they don't want to do this, so they choose scenarios to analyze that make the technology look bad.
Can solar management damage the ozone layer?
For sure. So putting sulfates in the stratosphere can damage the ozone layer. They do that actually by, in a sense, catalyzing the effectiveness with which chlorine, which humans put in there from chlorofluorocarbon refrigerants and other uses, it's the chlorine burden of the stratosphere that's caused ozone depletion, and adding sulfuric acid can make it worse. So yes.
And I'm concerned about pollution in general. Some scientists calculate global dimming from aerosols and dust may be cooling the planet up to 1 degree C already. If we cut that pollution back, say as a public health measure, we might get a burst of warming. Would that make geoengineering more likely, say as a replacement for that pollution shield, if you want to call it that?
Yeah, if you're sort of in salesmanship mode, that's one of the strongest arguments for doing some solar geoengineering. So right now, the pollutants in the lower atmosphere, particularly sulfur, are a huge global health hazard, perhaps the largest single global health hazard associated with energy. So sulfuric acid air pollution kills more than 2 million, or more than a million anyway, people a year globally. It's a big number. And obviously, the public health measure, it would be enormously beneficial if we reduce those pollutants. And we're beginning to do it. Even in China, air pollution regulations are now sufficiently strong that China has passed its peak sulfur emission, and its sulfur emissions are headed down in China. So just as you said, that sulfur is also reflecting away sunlight and cooling the planet. So as we remove it, we'll see a sudden increase in warming. And so I think it's quite plausible to say that the right thing to do would be to cut the sulfur emissions to the lower atmosphere and perhaps put a tiny amount. You only need like a 50th or less, or a 100th as much, sulfur into the stratosphere, where it would provide the same amount of cooling with much less health impact.
Will the particles added by SRM cause acid rain? That's a question I get quite a bit.
The practical answer is no. The technical answer is yes, but an absolutely tiny, unmeasurable, or nearly unmeasurable amount. So to give you a sense of the magnitude, we now put about 50 million tons of sulfur into the lower atmosphere, which causes acid rain in some locations. And for solar geoengineering, if you did it with sulfate, and there are other things you could do, but if you did it with sulfate, you'd be talking about maybe 1 or 2 million tons, so a few percent of the current amount, and it would be evenly distributed globally instead of concentrated near industrial production. So the impact, environmental impact with respect to acid rain, I think is pretty close to a non-issue, or very, very low down the list of serious concerns.
And finally, in my list of complaints, what about the idea that SRM does nothing to address ocean acidification?
Two answers. So one answer is that, to a good approximation, that's true. But we don't typically oppose things just because they're only partial solutions. So if you have some kind of cancer and I have a chemotherapy which can cure most of your cancer but not one part of it, or you know, causes some side effect, you might still think that you're much better off with the chemotherapy. So the short answer is that the long-term ocean acidification of accumulated CO2 isn't changed much by solar geoengineering. In fact, it's actually not quite true, because if we let the climate warm from increased CO2 in the atmosphere over the next century, the oceans will release extra CO2 into the atmosphere because of the warming. And if you held the warming back with SRM, you'd actually have reduced the net sort of effective emissions of CO2 by as much as 100 gigatons, which is a lot. I mean, it's equivalent roughly of, you know, U.S. emissions over the century. So there actually is some benefit to ocean acidification of doing solar geoengineering. Of course, the real terror that people have is that doing solar geoengineering will cause people to slacken off on their already extraordinarily slack efforts to cut emissions, and so then the problem will be worse.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking about cooling off the Earth using artificial means. It's called geoengineering. My guest is one of the world authorities on the subject, Dr. David Keith from Harvard University. Now, on the off topic of chemtrails, you've taken the time to speak with people who vilify you, David, as the devil of geoengineering. Have you received hate comments, and why do you try to still engage with people who disagree with you?
Well, I think, I guess one answer is that's the right thing to do, and it's often actually quite a positive experience. So the people who believe in this thing called chemtrails seem to have a variety of different beliefs, but they believe that the government is, or governments are somehow deliberately introducing chemicals or toxins to commercial aircraft is typically what they believe. And then people have a bunch of theories for why that's true, from kind of mass killing a population to climate control. I think there's essentially no chance that that's actually true. And my reason for saying that is not that I just trust what governments are telling me, but that it's very hard to keep big secrets like that. And if there really was such a program, it would be extraordinarily likely that it would leak out and people would have clear proof. And yeah, I have received twice, I guess we've had death threats serious enough to call the police for, but I've also have talked with people who hold that view quite a lot. And almost all the people I've talked to in person have been really respectful and thoughtful and had a real, you know, been willing to engage in a real substantive dialogue. And I think, indeed, the chemtrails community is sort of shifting. So it used to be that I think people more believed in versions that were really about mind control or something. And now quite a bit of the chemtrails world, actually more kind of used to be more from the political right end of the spectrum. Now there may be more people in the chemtrails community who effectively believe that something like solar geoengineering is happening and that it's called chemtrails. And so while I don't believe there is any such thing happening, I think that if their concern is that, you know, the kind of global elites will make decisions about how to manipulate the climate, that's a completely valid concern, even though it's not happening yet.
Should the Paris climate talks in 2015 address geoengineering, or do we need a separate body to do that?
That's an impossible question. I mean, I guess the first question is how relevant are the Paris climate talks to what happens next on climate policy anyway? I think the answer to that is at best unclear. I think you can say the following. Serious discussions of climate policy ought to include discussion of solar geoengineering, because it's one of the major things that humanity could do to manage the problem. Not because we necessarily should do it. There are very good reasons for not doing it, but because it's not credible to kind of casually ignore it. It is one of the things that are the only ways to significantly reduce climate risks over a single lifetime. And so if you care about vulnerable people and ecosystems, I think you have to take the idea seriously. So credible climate talks ought to include it in a central way, but I don't think it will be discussed at Paris, and I don't think we necessarily need a separate forum to discuss solar geoengineering. What I think we need are more effective ways to discuss climate policy in general, including solar geoengineering.
As you know, the U.S. National Academy just agreed to more geoengineering research. What did they say, and what does it mean?
So the Academy did recommend that there be a research program, and even that it include, they said that outdoor experimentation could be useful in reducing some kinds of uncertainties. To be clear, the Academy doesn't directly create research funding, and while the Academy said that, it's still the case that there is no federal research, sort of organized federal research funding for solar geoengineering, and that's, I think, a real concern, because part of the way that you get legitimate kind of governance of science in democracies is by government funding that science and getting to make choices and have oversight into what's funded. And right now, that really isn't happening effectively. So a lot of research is happening by people kind of diverting existing research funds or other methods.
What can you tell us about geoengineering research in other countries?
There are certainly some research interests everywhere, most particularly in Europe. There's been lots of research in UK, Germany, France, probably most of all. And there are a couple of organized big research programs, kind of centrally funded research programs now in Germany especially and in the UK. They're mostly concerned with kind of the broad social science questions of how to think about the problem or assessing existing literature, not so much pushing ahead in new ways to maybe reduce the risks or understand new ways to make it work. But there is organized research, and I think it's interesting that that's happened in Europe and not in North America so far.
Would it be possible, David Keith, for a perceived enemy like North Korea or the new Islamic State to change our climate without international approval?
In sort of theoretical principle, yes. I think in practice, not really. So, yes, some of these methods could be implemented by a single state in the sense that, you know, for some ways you put material in the stratosphere, you really only need a single airfield and a pretty small number of aircraft. On the other hand, that's to have a pretty small effect that would be mostly beneficial, so it's not a very sort of effective weapon. And it would be very easy to stop. So, I mean, if North Korea, or your examples, or the Islamic State were doing this from an airfield, and the big powers wanted them to stop, it would be very easy to make them stop, either by military force or threat of force.
Could a relatively large-scale experiment in solar management happen without being detected?
It all turns on what the heck you mean by relatively large-scale. I mean, the kind of experiments that I and colleagues are talking about are, in many sense, incredibly small-scale. So I'm working on the development of an experiment that would perturb a tiny area of the stratosphere and measure the chemical impacts. But we're talking about releasing like 100 grams of sulfate, which would be the equivalent of what is released by a minute's flight or so of a commercial aircraft. So I'm sure you could pull off a thing like that undetected. On the other hand, whether you think it's a good idea or not, it doesn't have any measurable climate impacts. I think it probably is conceivable that a country could pull off a substantially larger effort and it would be undetected, that would actually have some local impact, short-term impact on climate, yes.
What billionaires do you know that have expressed an interest in geoengineering, particularly SRM?
So a bunch of my work has been funded through gifts from Bill Gates, and we've used that as money as a purely philanthropic gift, and it's controlled through the usual controls that a place like Harvard has, and that's public. We've been very public about where all the money's gone, and it's funded quite a few researchers in some of the meetings on this topic. So that's by far the best example that I am familiar with. If by geoengineering you mean solar radiation management, there are lots of people who are wealthy people who talk about all sorts of things, but I'm not aware of anybody else who should have been seriously engaged in promoting research.
Well, fair enough. Have you heard interest in these technologies from either the U.S. military or secret agencies like the CIA?
Yeah, for sure. So the CIA approached me and several other leading researchers to ask about potential, same kind of questions you were asking about, could it be done covertly? Very much like the questions actually you just asked earlier in this interview. I had an interview with some CIA contractor a year or two ago, I forget. And there also have been people in the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, which is a research agency but run through for military, that have expressed some interest. So there certainly is some. I'm from a kind of left-wing Canadian background, so I find all that pretty disturbing. But it's important actually not to overstate it. The military is sort of by definition interested in an enormous range of things, and the fact that there's some tiny little military interest in one thing doesn't mean that there's a sustained interest or the military is actually doing anything. So I think that, at least from what I know, and I feel like I'm enough an insider, I probably know quite a bit, that while people are nervous about military action, there's no evidence of a sustained serious interest. I do think, looking forward, that it's really crucial that we focus on making these technologies as open and transparent as possible as early as possible. So, for example, I would be opposed to, say, large-scale funding of this research by DARPA, even if the research that they were funding was all made public and was really useful, well-organized research, because I think it would send a very bad signal to the rest of the world, and it could lead to a kind of a arms race is too strong, but to a tendency to secrecy that could be very destructive to kind of international confidence and trust in this area. So if the U.S. did that, then, you know, Chinese officials would likely do the same thing. So I think the hardest thing about this technology is not the technology itself, but it's figuring out how to manage it in a divided world. And for that reason, I think it's very important that early research be as open and transparent as possible.
So, David Keith, wrapping up, where does that leave us? Do you advocate starting solar radiation management now, sometime in the future, or maybe never?
The second two. As I said in the beginning, I think in the near term, what I advocate very strongly is a real commitment to research that should have happened 20 years ago. And because the potential benefits seem so large, I think a big research effort is really warranted. From what I see now, I think you can make a case, I would make a case, that it might make sense to begin very slow, moderate and slow ramp up of solar geoengineering quite quickly, so within a decade. That would only be true, though, if there was a big scientific research effort and if that effort kind of bore out the early knowledge we have so far.
We've been talking with Dr. David Keith. This Harvard-based scientist has been involved in many, if not most, serious discussions about the science of geoengineering and public policy. Find links to his website and work in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. David's latest book on this is A Case for Climate Engineering from MIT Press. David, I'm hoping to have you back again on Radio EcoShock to talk about sucking carbon out of the air. Will you join us again later?
Sure, I'd be very happy to. Thanks a whole lot.
Thank you, David, for your time today. I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. A group of people, perhaps even some of my listeners, believe there is a worldwide conspiracy to control the weather and maybe your mind and health by dumping chemicals out of aircraft at high altitudes. They call these persistent high clouds chemtrails. Now the internet phenomenon of chemtrails and its movement sets itself up to fight off geoengineering, like solar radiation management, which it sees as more of the same that's already happening. A subset of chemtrails believers also want to stop climate negotiations. They don't believe in human-induced climate change. We're going to explore the meaning of the chemtrails meme. Our guest has written a sociological analysis of the chemtrails phenomenon. We will not argue whether or not the chemtrails conspiracy is true or false. Instead, Rose Cairns investigated the methods and possible meaning of this underground movement. Dr. Rose Cairns is a research fellow at the Science and Technology Policy Research Unit at the University of Sussex in England. She's also been an environmental campaigner. We're going to talk about her paper titled Climates of Suspicion, Chemtrail Conspiracy Narratives, and the International Politics of Geoengineering. It was published online in April 2014 by the Climate Geoengineering Governance Project. Rose, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I loved your paper. It's deep and it takes unexpected twists, just like the subject of chemtrails, don't you think?
Thanks. I really enjoyed writing the paper. I find the whole subject really fascinating, particularly the way that the chemtrail belief relates to or doesn't relate to the more mainstream discourses around geoengineering. And I mean, I only recently came across the topic, actually. I'd had noticed on my Facebook page a couple of posts from various acquaintances over the years, but I hadn't really paid it much attention. But it's only in the last couple of years that I've been involved in a project looking at geoengineering governance, so looking at the whole kind of range of social, ethical, political, economic, legal, and so on issues raised by the growing interest in geoengineering that I started to come across these views more and more. And it struck me as really, really quite interesting that on the one hand, there are lots of people talking about the importance of involving the public in decisions about geoengineering and geoengineering research, and in understanding the full range of kind of concerns that the public have around issues of climate control. And then on the other hand, you have this belief in chemtrails. And it was interesting to me that no one had, to date anyway, paid any attention to this belief. And my feeling was when I started out that if we are genuinely interested in what people think and feel about climate control, that the chemtrail narrative might actually be a really interesting and revealing place to start. So that was where I'm coming from with it.
How big is the chemtrails movement?
It's quite difficult to get a handle on that. I mean, if you happen to work in research connected to geoengineering, you will no doubt have come across chemtrail activists. So there are often small groups of people who regularly attend academic conferences and debates or protest outside them. But obviously, in terms of actual numbers, it's quite hard to say. I mean, if you do a Google search for chemtrails, you'll get millions of hits, and it's an ever-expanding amount of information. There's only been one paper that I know of that's tried to quantify the size of the movement, which was a survey done back in 2011, which included a question about chemtrails. And I think it found that about 2.6% of their sample, which was over 3,000 people, believed in chemtrails, and about 14% believed in it to some extent. So although I think it's probably fair to say it is a fringe concern, it's not actually insignificant. There are a fair number of people who hold these beliefs.
Is this really then an internet phenomenon? And if so, how could you study it?
I think that the internet has definitely facilitated the growth and spread of the belief, and that can make it challenging to study. But on the other hand, it does provide quite an accessible window into the belief without needing to actually find groups of people to interview who may, for various reasons, be unwilling to share their thoughts and feelings with an academic. Obviously, there are different kinds of approaches to studying something so vast and nebulous as the chemtrail narrative. Some people might want to take a kind of quantitative approach using software to look at whether it might be co-word analysis or something like that. But my interest was more in the kind of qualitative dimensions of the debate. So really getting a handle on the content of the belief. So the particular approach I took in this paper was just to take a sample of sites, the top 20 sites from my reading of the sites, and out of the thousands of possibilities, and examine these in more detail using a kind of thematic discourse analysis.
Well, please tell us about a couple of the websites you catalogued for your research.
Well, the sites are quite diverse, as is the kind of content of the belief. So in my paper, I've listed a number of different sites that I looked at. There's a few consistencies in among all the sites, which is the idea that the central belief that persistent contrails are produced by airplanes are actually evidence of a secret program of spraying. But different sites, and within the same sites, there are different suggestions about what substances are actually being sprayed. So you have some sites referring to aluminium, others to pathogens, or even in some cases things like desiccated blood. And there are different possible motivations for the spraying on different sites. So issues like population control to various kinds of profit motivations in different guises feature quite prominently on different sites. So one motivation I've read is the idea that someone somewhere is making a lot of money from manipulating the weather and kind of playing futures markets, or to melt the ice in the Arctic to allow oil drilling, or poisoning soil so that only GM plants can grow. That the list goes on, and that they're not necessarily consistent with one another. So while the narrative on these different sites can seem a bit disjointed and inconsistent, there are some shared features. So most collate evidence in the form of photos and videos of these supposed chemtrails. And often they have personal histories about health impacts or kind of stories of awakening, how people have come to believe in the issue. And often they also promote activism and kind of action around how to stop this from going on.
Rose Cairns, before we go any further, let's take a hard look at what the label conspiracy theory really means. How do you understand it?
Well, actually, in my paper, I'm quite careful of using the term conspiracy theory and the label of kind of conspiracy theorist. As it strikes me, it's quite difficult, really, to define what one means, although it is kind of widely understood as being quite kind of pejorative. So I tend to prefer to stick to the term conspiracy narrative, even though it's quite a small shift, which I hope has fewer of these kind of pejorative connotations. And it also doesn't necessarily imply that the theory in question is false, although I don't happen to believe in chemtrails. I think that the term conspiracy theory has less actually to do with the truth or falsity of the claim and more to do with the relative power of the person or group making the claim.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. As we continue with Dr. Rose Cairns on the conspiracy theory called chemtrails. But there are, as we know, plenty of real conspiracies. Major banks admitted they fixed everything from interest rates to the price of gold. The George Bush administration conspired to start a war in Iraq. So is it irrational to believe in a conspiracy?
Oh, definitely not. I think you would have to be naive in the extreme to assume that the workings of power are always transparent and benign. And as you say, conspiracies have taken place throughout history. So the existence of a suspicion of conspiracy clearly isn't irrational in and of itself. And it's partly for this reason, as I say, that I'm cautious about the term conspiracy theory, which kind of assumes that it's possible to kind of mark out or delineate a class of suspicions or theories that are unfounded and unreasonable by looking at some of their generic characteristics. I mean, some people have tried to do this. For example, some people have tried to define conspiracy theory by suggesting that they're all unfalsifiable and they all require the suspicion to encompass an ever-expanding range of actors and institutions in order to maintain the belief. But there will always be exceptions to any rule. And as you say, the existence of real conspiracies, which there are, obviously they do exist, makes any attempt to define conspiracy theory as false theory very, very difficult. However, I would say it's not the case that, I don't think that one can still deny or try to disprove the existence of a given conspiracy. And as I say, in the case of chemtrails, I don't happen to think that the evidence for the claims is convincing at all. So personally, I don't believe in their existence. But I do think that one should be careful about how one labels a belief like that.
So when did the chemtrails idea start? Do we know?
It's fairly recent, within the last 20 years. As far as I can work out, the first article which suggested that jets were spraying substances and this was making people sick was published online back in 1999, and it seems that the chemtrail term for this emerged later on in that year. So fairly recent.
Why don't formal scientists like to talk about chemtrails?
I think this is a really interesting question and something I was quite surprised by when I started this project. This fact that there are these two parallel discussions going on at the same time around geoengineering on one hand and chemtrails on the other, but the fact that they don't interact at all. I think there are various reasons for this. I mean, firstly, I think I do have to accept that it is quite challenging to interact with chemtrail believers if you aren't one of them. And I think many scientists will have had some negative experiences with these kinds of interactions or attempting to have these interactions at conferences or through being contacted by chemtrail activists. And secondly, I think there is some worry, and I do share this to an extent, that the whole chemtrail discourse is in some ways quite a big distraction from other really important questions that research into geoengineering raises. So I think some, maybe more social scientists, are slightly wary of being drawn into discussions about chemtrails when they'd rather focus on other issues.
In your paper, you make a telling comparison between the downtrodden chemtrails people who want to save the world from a grave danger and the very scientists they fear who also want to save the planet with geoengineering, even though they are vilified for talking about it. Are there valid similarities there?
Well, I wouldn't want to overplay the similarities because clearly the groups are very different, but I did find some parallels which I explore in my paper. I mean, for example, both the mainstream discourse around geoengineering and the chemtrail narrative routinely frame their discussion in terms of climate emergency, using terms like global catastrophe, tipping points of no return, etc. And there are also parallels, I think, in the way that the discussion frames heroic individuals, whether these are, in the geoengineering discourse, kind of engineers or climate scientists, or in the chemtrail discourse, activists on the other, who are represented in both cases as kind of humanity's best last chance. So I think there are some interesting parallels, but as I say, I wouldn't want to overplay that.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm talking with Rose Cairns from the UK. Rose, is the chemtrails movement actually affecting anything? For example, are they politically active?
Well, as I mentioned, most chemtrail websites contain information about activism strategies, which include forms of political action ranging from lobbying politicians to holding demonstrations and so on. But I do think that to date, the political impact of the chemtrail movement has been fairly small. I think that possibly the existence of belief, that belief may have impacts on a broader kind of social debate around climate engineering, which may be possibly in disruptive ways.
Did you find evidence that some chemtrail sites are also centers for denial of climate change?
Yeah, this was one of the interesting findings from the study. Not all sites, but a fair number expressed this view that climate change is itself an elaborate hoax and that if it's happening at all, it's the result of deliberate geoengineering. And at first I was kind of surprised by this link, but when you think about it for a while, it begins to make sense in the sense that within the chemtrail belief, you can detect quite a particular view of how the world works. And within that view, there seems to be little room for kind of blind social or economic forces. Rather, it's the case that things are the way they are because of particular deliberate actions of specific groups of powerful people. And within this view of the world, then, the notion that we're all somehow unwittingly changing the global climate through our addiction as a society to fossil fuels doesn't really make sense. It doesn't fit within that particular view of the world. So mainstream understandings of climate change, while there may be powerful actors that are more at fault than others, ultimately we're all implicated and there are no simple solutions. This doesn't, I think, sit comfortably with a more conspiratorial view of the world.
Now, in my own exploration on the net, I found a nexus of beliefs on the site called Aircrap and a link to a site called His Heavenly Armies, which is a Jesus blog. Both contain screeds against vaccines, abortion, the American HAARP installation, and, of course, geoengineering. Is this chemtrails movement coming from the left or right spectrum of political belief?
Again, a really interesting question, and I found it very difficult to classify the belief along a kind of traditional left-right political spectrum. There are certain elements that resonate with what might be considered more left-wing concerns, such as concern with the environment, social injustice, and corporate power. But on the other hand, as you've mentioned, there are links with climate skepticism, and there are concerns out there that might more easily be classified as right-wing, such as those about individual freedoms, big government, and so on. So it's problematic. It doesn't sit neatly along that left-right spectrum.
I've interviewed David Keith, the Canadian-born scientist who has organized conferences on geoengineering. He's had death threats, he told me. How do chemtrails people interact with the small circle of geoengineering scientists?
I mean, I've also had some negative interactions with chemtrail believers, and actually in particular in response to this paper, which I found slightly ironic because part of my rationale for writing the paper was to suggest that not all of these beliefs can be just dismissed as irrational. But I got listed on a site called the Disinformation Directory along with a particularly unflattering university mugshot and several pages of quite nasty stuff about me and about my work. So I've had those negative interactions. I've never had death threats or anything nearly that serious. But on the other hand, I wouldn't want to make too many generalizations about the group of people as a whole or their interactions with scientists, as they are very diverse. I mean, I've also had acquaintances and even family members who've tried to convince me of the truth of these claims, so I'm very conscious of not wanting to suggest that all chemtrail believers are the same or act in the same way. And I've witnessed a full spectrum of interactions from very polite interactions between chemtrail activists and scientists in conferences right through to colleagues who regularly get nasty emails or calls. So there's a broad spectrum there.
Right. Well, one chemtrail activist wants people to go to the Paris climate talks this year. She thinks those talks will just legitimate the spraying that is already happening and call it geoengineering. This could become very strange, don't you think?
I think it already is quite strange. As I say, chemtrail activists regularly attend geoengineering conferences, and I think the effect can be quite disorienting, particularly for people who are new into these debates. My concern is that if large numbers do attend a given event, then important questions about geoengineering don't actually get the discussion and the airtime they deserve. And that would be my main worry about that.
Now, despite the tiny risk of violence, your paper doesn't characterize belief in chemtrails as a pathology, as you've just talked about. How should we think about it then?
I'm not really sure. This is something I've gone around and around. I mean, I think it may be symptomatic of something broader to do with the way that we as a society are relating to climate and climate change more broadly. For example, Mike Hume from King's College London writes about how we now all live in what he calls a climate of fear about our future climate. And we routinely use words like catastrophe and terror and extinction and so on. And perhaps in one way you might read the emergence of the chemtrail narrative not as a kind of aberration, but actually just one, albeit fairly extreme, manifestation of this wider cultural shift about how we relate to climate.
If I read between the lines, Rose Cairns, it seems to me you're saying to the scientific community and the academic community, look, these people and their belief may seem inconvenient, but they exist and they're already impacting the possibilities of public action. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, in a way. I'm just highlighting that by dismissing the whole belief outright as unfounded, you might miss really important insights and concerns that might resonate with broader publics. So, for example, in my paper, I argue that it's possible to distill out some elements of the chemtrail belief that are highly relevant to mainstream geoengineering discussions and will resonate with people even if they don't believe that a spraying program is happening. So, for example, people are disgusted with the idea of powerful elites controlling the global climate. They're angry about being left out of decision-making. They're fearful of the experimental nature of geoengineering, not wanting to be seen as lab rats. They have powerful emotional and spiritual connections to the weather and climate, and concerns like these are not routinely considered as being important in many geoengineering discussions. And these, I think, are very similar concerns that raised by people about geoengineering and are relevant and should be taken into consideration in geoengineering debates.
Well, along those lines, let's picture a real climate emergency. Say the Arctic Ocean has gone to blue ocean and a burst of heat has wiped out grain crops even more seriously than actually happened in 2010 in the Russian heat wave. Scientists researching geoengineering tell the public we can take quick action to cool things down while we figure out what else to do. But the public's already primed against solar radiation management because of chemtrails, and so we do nothing. Is that a possible result of the chemtrails movement?
I'm not sure that would be my main concern. I think for a start, it's worth highlighting, from my point of view anyway, emergencies aren't discovered, they're declared. So any notion of a climatic emergency would emerge through political processes as much as being declared by scientists and would likely be contested by different people. And I think the notion of a climate emergency is also problematic because states of emergency often go hand in hand with the suspension of normal democratic procedures. So I would be quite wary of that particular framing. Secondly, and importantly, I think it's really crucial to stress that there are really a lot of important critiques of geoengineering that have nothing to do with belief in chemtrails. So the work of campaigning groups like the ETC group and of academics like Clive Hamilton, Mike Hume, and many others are very critical about the potential for geoengineering interventions to make a positive contribution to climate policy or the amelioration of climate change. I mean, they've highlighted multiple social, political, ethical concerns around the politics of such interventions, the way they might have potential for weakening commitments to greenhouse gas, or that such interventions might be used for other purposes, and so on. And these and many other critiques form the basis of ongoing discussions around geoengineering governance. I think there is a danger that the focus on chemtrails risks obscuring or confusing these debates.
Well, you know, some people encountering the chemtrails thing go through an emotional and sometimes life-changing experience, and I've heard the same from a few of my listeners who suddenly get the reality of climate change. Are those different experiences?
I think there are some parallels, particularly probably in the sense of powerlessness that people can feel about climate change and likewise about chemtrails. But I think they're also very different in the sense that the understanding the drivers of climate change doesn't necessarily involve identifying particular individuals or institutions as being to blame, although sometimes it can do. So I think it's kind of slightly a different thing.
Now, some of my Radio EcoShock listeners are already deeply offended that we haven't spent our time proving chemtrails are real. And others are wondering how to deal with people that they know that are into chemtrails. Are there avenues of communication, or would you guess that most chemtrails folks are insulated from further facts or arguments?
Well, I started out writing the paper believing that the chemtrail narrative contained some important insights for mainstream geoengineering policy and for debates around public engagement. And I hope to have shown that it does, and that many of the concerns that the claim are based on can't just be dismissed as irrational. However, I'm not particularly hopeful for kind of productive engagement between chemtrail believers and others, as my own personal interactions have not been particularly productive. And I think it is quite challenging to have productive interactions with someone who thinks you're either blind or naive or stupid for not seeing what they believe is going on, or you see it but you're pretending not to, so in other words, you're part of the conspiracy. So when you're offered these two people, which one would you like to be, it's not very fertile ground for helpful interaction. So I have to say I'm a little bit pessimistic.
Now, the Internet's always spinning with new bits of this worldwide conspiracy, complete with photos and other alleged proof. Is that never-ending quality part of the phenomenon?
I think so. I do. I mean, I'm not sure what the chemtrail belief would have looked like or if it would have been able to take off in the way it has without this medium of the Internet and kind of the way it allows this kind of ever-expanding amount of information.
It's almost addictive. So given the miasma that is chemtrails on the net and the mirror images in official beliefs of all kinds, how could you possibly come to a conclusion, or did you?
Well, I wasn't really kind of testing a hypothesis as such. I mean, all I set out to do was explore the content of the belief and how it articulates or otherwise with mainstream geoengineering discourse. So I don't think I would necessarily have a take-home conclusion about it as such.
Well, I came away from the paper thinking chemtrails conspiracy isn't any nuttier than some of the real conspiracies we've already encountered in governments and business and wars. Maybe chemtrails is just part of life's rich pageant. Should we just accept it?
Well, I don't think it's likely to go away anytime soon, especially given the increasing amount of attention being paid to geoengineering, as, for example, illustrated in the release of the recent reports on climate intervention by the U.S. National Academies of Science. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who dedicate a lot of time to trying to highlight or disprove the theory, so looking at the inconsistencies or flaws in the belief by using science. So these are the so-called debunking sites, which you've probably come across, like Metabunk or Contrail Science. And these sites have taken the approach of trying to prove that the view is false. But it strikes me that while I understand and respect what they're doing, I don't think they're going to be successful in convincing chemtrail believers that their beliefs are unfounded, because ultimately it isn't that people have a lack of data at their disposal, but rather a lack of trust. And once trust is lost, I think it's very hard to regain.
Is there anything you would like to add, a final message for our listeners?
I guess I'd just like to stress again my personal view that although I don't believe in chemtrails, I do think many of the concerns expressed within the chemtrail narrative may well resonate with other publics, and that dismissing them as irrational isn't a good idea. I also think for those interested in thinking through possible implications of geoengineering interventions, particularly solar radiation management methods, the kind of pervasive suspicions and lack of trust that are characteristic of the chemtrail narrative might offer quite a revealing window of insight into the future by highlighting the kinds of dynamics that would likely accompany any geoengineering intervention. And finally, I think it's important that the chemtrail debate doesn't overshadow some of the important and pressing governance questions around geoengineering research that societies really need to think through given the current growth of interest in the topic. And I would be concerned if the issue of chemtrails became a distraction from these important debates, so I hope that doesn't happen.
Chemtrails, it's up to you. We've been talking about the role of this persistent belief in society and the debate on geoengineering. Our guest, Dr. Rose Cairns, wrote the paper Climates of Suspicion, Chemtrail Conspiracy Narratives and the International Politics of Geoengineering. That was published by the Climate Geoengineering Governance Project. Find the links you need in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Rose, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thanks.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
On Radio EcoShock, you often hear me try to expand our view beyond humans to the many other marvelous creatures that live here on Earth. It's time to hear about one of them. Call them salamanders or call them newts, but in too many parts of the world, we have to call them endangered. Our guest has dedicated his life to saving the salamanders. Matt Ellerbeck works through public education, in schools, and through the media, and through his website at SaveTheSalamanders.com. Matt, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Now look, it's possible millions of people have never seen a live salamander. What do they look like and where do they live?
So salamanders sort of look like lizards, but they're not a type of lizard like most people think they are. They're actually amphibians like frogs and toads. So they're not lizards and they're not reptiles at all. And an easy way to tell a salamander apart from a lizard by looking at them is salamanders have moist-looking skin. They don't have scales on their bodies and they don't have claws on their feet. So if you were out hiking and you seen a little lizard-like creature and you weren't sure if it was a salamander or a lizard, by just looking for the presence or lack of scales and claws, you can determine whether you're looking at a salamander or a lizard. And you just mentioned that most people haven't seen salamanders in the wild. And the reason that is because these animals are really secretive. They tend to live either in wetlands or ponds for aquatic species, which we generally call newts, or live in damp, moist, forested, or woodland areas. And within those areas are often found either underground or under natural debris like leaf litter, rocks, fallen logs, and things like that. So they're often hiding out of sight, and that's why most people don't tend to encounter them.
How small do these creatures get, and how big are the biggest ones?
Some of the smallest salamanders are, you know, only a few centimeters long, and then could easily fit in the palm of your hand, while they are very large species, especially the Chinese and Japanese giant salamanders, which can be between, 4 and 5 feet long. And those are the largest amphibians in the world. So we have very large ones, and then we have very small ones, and then we kind of have species like, say, the tiger salamanders or mud puppies and things that are sort of intermediate, up to a foot long, some of those ones. And those would be considered large in most salamander terms, but certainly there are species bigger. So within that scope, although most of them would be considered small, there's quite a lot of diversity there in terms of their size.
And those salamanders have a fantastic ability. If they lose a limb, they can regrow it. Do we know how they do it?
Scientists are still looking at that and trying to determine the exact mechanisms on how they do that. But as you just mentioned, you know, it's an incredible ability, and obviously it generates a lot of attention, especially in terms of medical research, because, you know, if we could figure out how a salamander does that, then maybe similar applications could be applied to humans one day. And not just limbs. I've read reports about, you know, certain species, even if they lose maybe part of their bottom jaw or even an eyeball, regenerating those. They have an amazing ability to regenerate.
And Matt, where have you been looking for salamanders?
I've spent a lot of time across Ontario looking for salamanders, and we have about a dozen species within the province. I've also spent some time, though, in Tennessee, so in the southern Appalachia region, looking for salamanders. And the reason I headed to that spot in particular is that region has more salamander species than anywhere else in the world. So last spring, I set off to go down there, and one day I'd seen 50 salamanders. So it's the salamander hotspot of the world, which is really interesting, because often when people think about reptiles or amphibians, they often think of the tropics or rainforests as being the hotspots for diversity. And certainly that is true of some of those types of animals, but for salamanders, it happens to be right here in North America. So it's nice that I kind of live within that region.
Now, if you had to rank the biggest threats to salamanders, what would they be?
I think the biggest one, and keeping in mind when I'm talking about these, that often these threats are interrelated and interconnected, but I think the big one would be habitat loss. And that's true of many species that are now designated as threatened or endangered. I mean, if you take an animal's home away from it, whether it's developmental construction or for agriculture or what have you, when natural areas are destroyed and animals have no place left to live, obviously their odds of survival are greatly compromised. What can also happen, though, is called habitat degradation. So say a forest is cut down half of it and we put in a subdivision or some urban construction, and then the rest of the forest is left adjacent to that area. What can happen is contaminants like oils and pesticides and gasolines and other chemicals can enter the nearby remaining habitat. And because salamanders are amphibians, they're very, very prone to chemicals and contaminants in the environment, and their skin is very permeable. So they almost act like a sponge. They're very absorbent, and they absorb things in their environment. So those kind of contaminants can severely degrade their habitats, the remaining areas in which they have to live, and they can cause mass die-offs. They can cause low reproductive output. So the salamanders that are breeding, the young have a very low survival rate, and the ones that are born often have various mutations. So it's not just taking their habitat away, but sort of altering and degrading what's left. Also, pollution and climate change are a big problem for salamanders. Again, being amphibians, they like moist, cool environments generally, not hot and dry. And when we have climate change and you have areas that are getting hotter and drier, and certainly more so than previously, that can severely affect them as well. And then one of the last threats that salamanders face that most people might be surprised to hear is actually harvesting from the wild. So some are captured for the pet trade, while many others are actually caught for food markets. And I think when people hear this, it's easy to point fingers and be like, oh, that must happen in foreign countries, because obviously I do most of my outreach education, you know, in Ontario. I travel across Ontario, and when people hear that, they're like, oh, that doesn't happen here. But I've actually talked to conservation officers who work through the Ministry of Natural Resources, and, you know, mud puppy salamanders, which are an aquatic species found in rivers and lakes, have turned up in food markets in Toronto. So certainly with all the other threats that we talked about, you know, habitat loss, pollution, climate change, disease, degradation, we don't need, on top of all those things, animals being directly targeted and removed from the environment and then taken and used that way. And when we add all those threats up together, it accounts for a massive amount of salamanders being lost every year, primarily due to human-induced threats.
Looking through your website, I was also struck by the callous ability of humans to abuse salamanders. The one that touched me most was live salamander keychains. Tell us about that, please.
So this is something that has come to my attention via social networking, and I tend to see it quite a bit, which is horrific to see on the one hand, but at least more and more people are becoming aware of it. And the live salamanders are harvested primarily for tourist trades in parts of Asia, and it happens with other small animals too, unfortunately. And what they do is the salamanders are sealed in these plastic cases with a tiny bit of water and then sold as a keychain where you have a tiny little salamander living in it. And unfortunately, you know, people might see this and be like, oh, isn't that neat, and become enthralled with it. But you have to kind of stop and think about, how did that animal end up there? And they become trapped in these tiny plastic enclosures where, unfortunately, they either slowly starve or suffocate and have no ability to give them proper care. So you can imagine how cool that is to just have something sealed up like that, where it's devoid of any sort of proper care and treatment and will just slowly die. With all that being said, salamanders are vertebrate animals, you know, just like a dog and a cat. And just like a dog and a cat, you know, they breathe air, they bleed blood, and they can feel pain. They have pain receptors, and they are fully capable of experiencing pain and suffering. So those of us who wouldn't want to see, you know, any other animals abused or subjected to cruelty, we should apply that same principle to salamanders and other forms of life as well. I don't think we should pick and choose. I think we should apply that compassion to all living things.
So what can we do to keep these intriguing creatures among us here on Earth?
That's a great question. And I've tried to make things really easy for people. So on my website, which you mentioned the link at the beginning, savethesalamanders.com, there's a How You Can Help page on there. So I don't want to just fill people with doom and gloom. I want to inspire people to get active and get involved. So there's a huge list on there for both individuals, things that people can do to help, or say if you're a landowner, you have a summer home or a cottage, or perhaps you live in a rural area and you have some land, there's great stewardship activities on there too, habitat management guidelines that people can do. So again, simple things that everyone has the ability to do that can make a positive impact for salamanders. So I really encourage people, visit SaveTheSalamanders.com, click on the How You Can Help page, and just take a minute to learn what you can do to help. And
we've been talking about one of the lesser-known amphibians, the wonderful salamanders. Our guest is known as the Salamander Man. He's Matt Ellerbeck. Matt, I want to thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you very much, and thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Just for the record, you notice Rose Cairns made plain in that interview that she doesn't believe in the chemtrails conspiracy. And just for the record, neither do I. I'll explain more about that in my show blog at ecoshock.info, published every Wednesday. Just like the planet, we're out of time this week for Radio EcoShock. My thanks to everyone who tweets and spreads the word on Facebook about this program. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next week for more thrills and spills on planet Earth.